from Midori House in London, and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Coming up today, we look at how one creates the feeling of luxury. Also ahead, how one artist uses sounds like this to create beautiful artwork. Plus, a new way to cook Indian cuisine. And
underneath the floorboard was a flyer. And on the flyer it said, Corliss Claflin, theatrical variety and musical agent, English, American and continental. So I just wanted to find out more about Corliss.
The story of one house and its inhabitants. Plus, Juliet Foster will go through the weekend's papers. All that to come this hour, live from London, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24. In today's show, the Belmont Cadogan Hotel is opening its doors next week in Chelsea, and as you can imagine, it's as luxurious as you can get, including over 400 pieces of original art, access to private gardens, and a specialist restaurant. But how do you create such a luxury experience, and how do you pick the right kind of artwork to stand out amongst the hotel's many rooms? Well, to discuss this, I'm joined by Klaus Kablitz, who's general manager at Belmont Cadogan, and Adam Handling at Chef Patron. Welcome to the programme, both of you.
Thank you.
Klaus, should we start with you? Tell us about the idea behind the hotel.
It's Belmont's first hotel in London, a company that has been looking after clients for over 40 years, providing retreats, places where you can escape from day-to-day life. Now, in London, that's going to be a bit more difficult because people have lots of things to do. London has great attractions. But even for those short hours they come to the hotel, we want them to feel they're in London. And not just that, but they're in Chelsea. They're in a very particular part of town, connected to the locals. We have a great chef who will provide that neighborhood restaurant so our resident guests can tap into it, but also to have that piece of quiet when they're lying in their bath and have a glass of champagne and just read a good book about Oscar Wilde or from Oscar Wilde that he wrote probably while staying at the hotel many years ago.
Well, so tell us a little bit more then about that area and the history that links the present-day hotel with Chelsea.
The hotel started about 132 years ago. It was a small hotel, previously a pub, I believe, and then it grew into the building next door. So now it's this wonderful conglomerate of five Victorian buildings that have been beautifully restored, lots of old and new. But the Chelsea residents have always loved it. They came there over the century for various reasons, always to seek refuge of one sort or another. There were the bright young things of the 30s who came there to kick back their heels and have a bit of rest. And then the rock stars of the 60s came there for piping hot tea and a bit of rest from the craziness of the King's Road. And the whole thing happened again in the 80s when the fashion models came there to get away from the paparazzi and all that crowd. So it's always been that kind of a Chelsea retreat. But the locals have always loved it for something very different. They came there to entertain and to be entertained and to sort of see the big world coming and going. And that's exactly what we're trying to recreate again in a hotel fit for today, basically.
And it has a connection to Lily Langtry.
Indeed, yes, her room number 106 is still there, beautifully restored. Guests can stay there and experience what it was like to live in her townhouse, because even her entrance, number 21 Pont Street, is still there as number 21 Pont Street. So if you wish to come and go without being seen by the concierge, you can do exactly that.
How fantastic. Adam, let's talk about art, because it's very important to the hotel and you've amassed an impressive collection. How have you gone about that?
I work with a lot of artists because it's one of our table legs to our table, food, alcohol, art and music. And I like the thing there, you can be inspired by certain stuff and it can also provoke emotion. And the art that we've chosen in the restaurant, I think it just does that. Ones that you sit at and you're noticing something else and something else and something else. It's not just one picture and you see it and it's done. You can see things pop out.
Mm. And you've commissioned a lot of this work specially for the restaurant.
Yeah, Katie J. Dobson. She did the main restaurant room, and it's incredible. I first met her art a couple of years ago when I was seeing she did a thing called Circle of Life, and I was inspired by a piece, and I actually used that in one of my other places. But this one here was something she's never done before. It was like everything that was the history of the hotel and its founders created an art.
Fantastic. And it's not just the restaurant. That art then continues throughout the hotel. I mean, how do you go about that, matching artworks to rooms and just getting a cohesive whole, Klaus?
That was a really interesting exercise. Initially, design managers had, you know, suggested certain things, and lots of copies were being commissioned. And I said, well, that's not right for this hotel. We are an original, you know, we need to have original art. So we just went out to look far further and found, you know, young British talent, and we gave them some ideas. We wanted to have art that reflected the Cadogan Place Gardens, for example. So nature is a huge theme around the hotel. My favorite is the Cadogan Oak. It's a beautiful oak tree in Cadogan Place Gardens, and that has been replicated 6 times in different colors, making a very functional corridor into a beautiful art gallery. And that really will draw people in and give them sort of the inside or the outside coming in and those kind of inspiring ideas.
Because I suppose, Adam, when you go in, you have to take some time first as the person in charge of this just to absorb the atmosphere of the place and find a way to make it speak to the resident.
For sure, for sure.
And it's, I mean, is it a complicated process for you? Does it take a long time?
Well, it's always very complicated because what you picture in your mind when it goes on the walls might be something completely different.
Yeah.
But I think with the team of people that have had an input in creating it and organising it, it actually works really lovely. But bringing outside, inside, nature, organic, that's something which is quite large.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in fact, you've inaugurated a scheme called the Belmont New Designers Award. What's that?
It's really looking for young, aspiring talent and giving them a theme or a subject. And in our case, it was two things. One, really more relevant to Adam's restaurant, but one for the hotel, a chair design. And, you know, this young, really fantastic designer has come up with this amazing chair design that we're going to have made and then, you know, exhibit and use in the hotel. Mm. It's just really connecting, you know, what we're all about. There's a historical element to our hotel, but we are very much a hotel of today. So giving today's young talent the chance, both in the hotel itself, as well as, you know, in the design world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the restaurant. What can people eat?
That's a lot. There's quite a large menu. The style is British foundations inspired by London. And I say that because it's about British luxury ingredients, but ones where you're walking up and down any street in London and the amount of nationalities and inspiration you get along them ways. So it's everything like that. You know, the beef, for instance, is Highland Wagyu from Scotland. It's an incredible small farm. We buy the whole animals and we utilise it that way. It's a lot of that sort of cooking.
Yeah. How many covers can you do?
In terms of seats, we'll do about 80 covers a night. And then we have a tea lounge, you know, we have a bar, we have a terrace. There's actually quite larger than just the one, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And in terms of tea, I mean, it's always been an institution at the hotel, hasn't it? And so how are you tweaking that?
The afternoon tea, we've been working on, I think, about 9-10 months now. And it's something to do with the history and the future. So the history is meaning that feeling of your grandmother's house. That's the one feeling which we want to invoke on all in the entire hotel. So it's the grandmother cakes sort of done like she would have done. My mother's recipe is still one of them. And then you've got the 4 modern ones, which is bringing the artistical approach to craftsmanship in terms of pastries. They're put together very organically, very naturally. It's done on a big bronze tree. So again, keeping in with the nature. All the cups, everything like that. They're all hand designed of nature and flowers. It's really natural.
It sounds absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's really good. Yeah.
How are you dealing with the whole rise in veganism? Clearly, that's something that every restaurant now has to be slightly cognizant of.
Oh, for sure. Well, the eat less meat and eat more veg has always been one. Which, well, to be fair, even your parents were trying to encourage when you were younger. But now it's just a little bit more focused. We have a vegan menu. We have a vegan tasting menu too, as well as a vegetarian.
Uh-huh. And in terms of tasting menus, that's something you can do across all cuisines within your restaurant?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we have a tasting and a la carte. But the idea is just because it's a really luxurious place and you have a tea room and all that, you can have whatever anywhere in the building. You know, it's not restricted by the restaurant or the bar. You want that in... on the terrace, you want afternoon tea, you have it there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very organic, natural, and that feeling of when you stepped into your grandmother's house.
And luxury, Klaus, isn't just about the look of things or even the taste of things. It's about how you make people feel. It's about the staffing and the service too, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's always been my biggest thing, the staff, finding the right people, motivating them, keeping them as long as I possibly can, and making sure they develop within our hotel. And for them to deliver that service that's right for everybody. People want different things, and you have to teach people that. I'm working with a trusted trainer that I've worked with for many, many years at my previous hotels, and he and his colleague have this way of teaching people simple things on how to greet somebody warmly and friendly, but not overly if that person is a more discreet person, or very enthusiastically if that person is a more warm, huggy person. Adam and I are just experiencing that by getting to know each other's personalities, and that's really very refreshing. But that kind of goes over to the way the staff treat each other and the way they then greet our guests. Yeah. It's all about this. We can never do enough for our guests. Just what is that, you know, and that's different. And for them to have the individuality and not to robotically learn phrases, you know, you must say this first and that second and that third, that's not us at all. You know, there's a certain framework which we give you, but then, you know, within it, you must be your own personality. And they were totally shocked. They couldn't believe that we were so loose on the one hand and yet so strict on the other hand. So we're doing role plays. You know, the lobby at the moment is just full of people running in front of cameras, and that's not videos for promotion. This is the trainers, you know, saying, no, that wasn't quite right. This guest doesn't feel warm enough. Do it again. And, you know, even the residents walking past the hotel think we've gone mental because the doorman is going up and down like crazy and there's not even a single guest inside. But it's all about, you know, getting the atmosphere right when the hotel does open its doors on Thursday.
Yeah, that's so exciting. Adam, I was just in a restaurant, which I won't name, attached to a very well-known hotel the other day. And I ended up basically having to tell the waitress to go away. It was so in your face. And there is a danger of that, isn't there?
There is. But like Klaus says, we have the foundations and we've given them the parameters to be in. But personality is super important. And reading customers, reading everyone, including your colleagues, about how you talk to them, how do you approach them. Prime example with me. Don't talk to me in the morning at breakfast time. Be fast and efficient and leave me alone. But then at lunchtime and dinner time, you can talk away.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about figuring out that person just by how they are. And that's actually the hardest thing to do. But as soon as you've mastered it, the customers and the guests, they have a great experience. Because
yeah.
It's like, wow, you know me so well. But only you can just read the body language.
Yeah, and I suppose not only here at the Belmont, but at lots of hotels, you build it up through return custom, and you've got, I suppose, a lot of information on returning guests, and you know Mr. X likes his newspaper at this time.
We're in a very lucky position. Belmont has obviously the famous train, the Orient Express, going from London straight down to Venice. And we have our beautiful Belmont Cipriani there. So we can really draw from that clientele, providing them for the first time in 41 years with a London home where they can stay before or after the journey, and then getting all this information. But it's not about having it already, it's about getting it. And many hotels sort of are very, very reactive. They wait for them to find out. We want to be more proactive. We have a certain set of preferences we do want to know. And if we don't know them when the guest arrives, or if we only know, let's say, 5 out of 7, then everybody is actively encouraged to find out, you know, what coffee does this guest like, so that the next time they come to the lounge, there it appears. Mm. You know, or what water preference is there, so the minibar is stocked with just still, but twice as many, rather than the usual still and sparkling. And it involves everybody. So we've grouped the team into sort of three main groups: on the floor service, lobby service, and F&B services. And within that, the teams work very closely together, even though they may work for different departments, and you know, share this information. So when the guest gets into the restaurant, he's kind of being introduced in that traditional British way, so that the restaurant staff knows, oh yes, and by the way, the maid has just found out that, you know, this guest does not like this particular tonic water, so it's never offered to him. So it's that kind of working together and team spirit that will make service so much more smooth and anticipatory. You know, guests will feel, oh, I don't even have to say what I want. They know anyway. How did that happen?
Can I move in?
Yes, please.
It sounds absolutely fabulous. Really, really amazing. And as you say, from the service to the food to the art, just to the pure luxury feel. So tell me again, it opens this week?
On Thursday, 28th of February.
Very exciting. Well, good luck to both of you. I'm sure it's going to be the most amazing success, and I can't wait to visit. Thank you to both Klaus Kabeletz and Adam Handling. And the Belmont Cadogan is opening, as they say, on the 28th of February. And you can read more for yourself, in fact, in the Travel Monocle Minute, which is coming soon. Now, still to come, we try food from the 7 sister states of India, and we go through the weekend papers. Stay with us.
Perk up and tackle Monocle's Fit February issue. This is an essential guide for those looking to get in fighting shape for 2019. First up, we take a look at the people leading the way in whittling their nation's waistlines from Qatar to Tonga to Norway. On to the business section, where we sit down with Airbus's CEO to talk about what's in store for aviation, before checking out the company's streamlining and speeding up deliveries. In culture, we meet Rome's top art restorers, and in design, we touch down in Parma to meet OLAB, the smart architecture firm that's transformed a palace into a sleek hotel. Monocle's February issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24. Now, Marieke Kaiser is an American artist who depends on sound as her muse. Kaiser collects field recordings that inspire and influence her work and has recently created a soundscape installation of 12 bells made out of different materials, each containing a speaker and entitled Time Thicket. She spoke to Monocle's Paul Osborne.
I wasn't always such a varied artist. I used to be sort of normal painter. And after a while, I got sort of frustrated with the limits of painting and how no matter what I was doing, I was asking the viewer to engage with the painting very mentally. They had to sort of agree that all the illusionistic things I was doing on the surface of the painting could be about space, could be about depth, could be about perspective and direction. And I realized that the idea that I was trying to work with would be better served by a different form. So I had to, you know, learn how to try it in a street performance. And then I wasn't super convinced by that. And I tried it as a live performance in a theater. And I tried it as a sound work. And I tried it as an animation with the soundtrack. I have this tendency now, after several years working like this, to try out one idea in a lot of sort of forms because I want to make sure I find the kind of best way of getting it across, if that makes sense.
A recent work, it involves bells with little speakers inside them. Tell us a little bit about this.
I got this opportunity to do a residency at a ceramic space called Rochester Square, which is in Camden. And I didn't know precisely what I was going in to do. I knew I wanted to make sounds, and I knew I wanted to use clay because I thought, if I'm going to make some kind of hollow instrument thing that I'm going to hit on or blow through or something, clay seems really quick and an easy way to make a form. And I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I hadn't really been using clay that much before. But I got on a potter's wheel and made a bell sort of by accident, because it's quite a natural shape to sort of occur under your hands when you're spinning clay at a high speed. And, you know, I fired it, and then I recorded the sound that it made, and I was like, oh, here we go. This is a sort of route that I can keep going down. So I made different bells out of different clays and fired them at different temperatures, and then glazed some of them and not all of them, and all of these variables affected the sound that the bells were making. And I had old recordings from before their very first firing, so their pitch was really low and dark, and then their pitch went up a lot after they were fired again. So I was just sort of fascinated by that really material effect on sound. And I wanted to be able to use the old recordings and the new recordings, so I figured I would stick speakers in the bells and hang them in a space and play back all of their possible sounds from within the bell.
And then part of this involves using an algorithm to extend the length of the notes.
That's true. There's a sort of cheesy sound effect that you can use. And a lot of people use this, and they'll take like a Justin Bieber song and they'll slow it down 64 times, and all of a sudden it just sounds like a chorus of angels. If you take a sound file it'll slice it up into lots of little pieces, and then you stretch it out, and it guesses what to fill in the blank spaces with. And what you get is a really extended version of your original sound file. And it usually sounds gorgeous.
In that piece, for example, it lasts about 7 minutes, but then on a loop. When you're doing something like that, to what extent are you thinking about the amount of time that someone actually experiences it for? Quite often in an exhibition, you'll go in, there'll be a video installation or an animation or maybe a film running, and most people probably only really experience it for 10 or 15 seconds and then they move on to the next thing. Is that something that's in your head when you're making something, or is that sort of irrelevant to it?
It's not in my head when I'm making it. When I'm making it, I'm only thinking about what I'm thinking, if that makes sense. Like, I'm listening to the composition as I make it, and I'm like, oh, this part's a bit too long, this part's boring, this part's not interesting enough. And that, you know, I'm just sort of suiting it to my taste, really, and how long I can pay attention to something. And we all know that, yes, especially in like a private view context or something, you won't necessarily have people's undivided attention for longer than like 7 seconds. And that's fine, you know, I make what I'm making and then I put it there in the room. And if it's as interesting as I find it to be, then at least some people will slow down and be caught by it. And that's enough for me.
You mentioned earlier that you sort of think about the thing you want to do next and then you work out what's the best medium for it. So presumably you're already thinking about the next thing. Do you think about one thing at once, or is it like, is it kind of almost like a chess player where your X moves ahead?
It's like a sort of running list of things I think I want to get around to. In this particular instance, I have a lot of recordings that I made recently. I was on a trip in Italy, Macedonia, and Greece, and I was using contact mics to get recordings off of like ancient ruins and, you know, tourist sites and stuff like that.
702, 727, 610.
And I have all these weird resonant stone recordings that I want to use in something, and I don't know what yet, but that's what I'm thinking about right now.
That was 583.
So part of it is as you kind of go somewhere, you see something or hear something and think that's going to be useful in some way in the future.
Yeah, I always have my recorder with me. I have this tiny little Zoom recorder, and I also have the Voice Memos app on my phone at all times. So if I hear something interesting, or if I just want to remember the conversation that I'm having, I use it the way I suppose some artists use photos or sketches, because those aren't really useful to me, but having an audio snippet of what happened to around me, or just the way the train sounded at a certain moment, you know, stuff like that. I'm always listening for things like that.
And that was Marieke Kaiser. You can see her work at the Fiumana Claes Gallery as part of the Discoveries show from now until the 6th of April 2019. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Now, we're going to return to Chelsea on our regular Sunday Brunch feature, Weekend Reads. Claire Hastings, the daughter of the writer Anne Scott James, began her career at Harper's & Queen magazine before she left to work as a stylist and costume designer. She's now returned to writing with her book, The House in Little Chelsea. It tells the story of a house in London's Little Chelsea and its inhabitants from 1873.
It's called Little Chelsea because it is very much on the borders of Chelsea proper. It's rather run down and down at heel, and still is. It's a very typical Victorian house. It's on a very long and unpromising road without very many trees. One of the few reasons I was able to afford to live there, really, is it wasn't... It's a street that's always been built for lodgers, I think, and it still retains that today. It's still a house very much filled with lodgers and boarders, and very few homes are left in single occupancy.
Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to research the history?
I didn't really research the history at all. It was all came about by chance. I'd actually been living in the house probably for about 15 years. And my partner was redecorating an upstairs bedroom and there was some loose floorboards. And he took one up and there underneath the floorboard was a flyer. And on the flyer it said, Corliss Claflin, theatrical variety and musical agent, English, American and continental. Well, this, of course, is a rather beautiful thing to find underneath the floorboard. It had the address of the house, which was misspelt, Finsborough Road, and it said that he was by appointment only. So I just wanted to find out more about Corliss, which, after all, is a bonkers name anyway.
So you went to the census, the National Census Records?
Well, I started off just trying to do things on Google, in fact. So I've tracked him down to Richmond, where he was an unpublished bookseller. I then found him setting up his stall as a photographer in the Strand. He moved to Ross Trevor Road in Fulham, and I lost him again, and I kind of forgot about him for a bit, although I had the flyer, which we framed and put on the wall. And then I actually employed a house hunter who came back with the census records, and there was the list of all the people who'd lived in the house since it was topped out in 1873. Literally the roof going on. And that was in 1873, and there they all were. I had their names, their ages and their occupations. And they were just sort of a wonderful collection, so I saw them jostling at the door trying to get in.
Mm. Do you get a sense, living in the house yourself, of those people, perhaps, I don't know, having left some emotional residue?
Well, I didn't before I found them. Like anyone who lives in a house, I'd given it very little thought apart from my own life there. When I saw them, I had to consider the layout of the house. The house I live in now is divided up into two sections. So I live in the top half and there are other people in the basement. So I then had to think about it as a whole house and how they interacted with each other. And it was very much from the start filled with lodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And the fortunes of the house have very much come up and down. It was built for the middle classes, but it went into disrepute remarkably quickly.
You had all these people's names, their ages.
Yes,
obviously,
yeah.
You knew their address.
Yeah.
But the book isn't straightforward fact because you kind of novelised their stories a little bit.
Well, yes, because obviously I didn't know anything about them. Apart from Corliss, as I say, he did crop up. As you get earlier and earlier, the people become less and less well-known. And they weren't very glamorous, a lot of them. They were bodice makers, postboys, a chiropodist. So I had to invent their stories. But I've tried to make it so that they are involved with the activities that were happening around the area at the time, because then it makes them feel more real, I hope.
Mm. Do you think a lot of people think about the ex-inhabitants of their homes?
Not really. I think they probably do more now that more television programmes have come out about it. And we have had a lot of information that you can find out things much more easily now than you could do many years ago. And I think people do think about their ancestry and more. But in fact, we all have to get on with life. So I don't think we've really got time to think very much about the previous occupants.
Mm.
Sadly, because it's well worth it.
Absolutely. I mean, just looking at the list of them, I mean, some of these professions just don't exist anymore, do they?
They don't exist in the same way. Now, I mean, there were a lot of bodice makers, and it is extraordinary that they were providing clothes for the couturiers up in Bond Street. And they very much did piecemeal work and very, very little money. I mean, these were very poor people. And I think you forget that in Chelsea, how many poor people there were just making do later on with a bathroom, but before that, just with a bowl and a china washstand. You know, that was sort of it for them. Mm-hmm. And very little funds. But I do like to think of them as very ordinary people, just getting on with life.
Because, of course, London itself has changed utterly in that time. You've gone
from,
I mean, as you say, a bowl of water to running water, or
yes,
gas lights to electricity,
yeah,
that kind of thing. And no more fog. That must have made a big difference.
It did. But I like to think that everybody has the same goals. I think we all look for love and life in the same way now as we probably did then. So I do like to think of my characters as still being quite modern. I mean, Hildebrand, who is a chef and is obsessed with cooking, I think he'd probably be Instagramming his dishes now if he had the choice. And Jane Golding, who's my middle-class newlywed, you know, she'd be signing up for craft workshops. So I kind of see them very much as modern people too. They just happen to have been born into a slightly earlier time.
Mm. So your first residence date from 1873, and then obviously
yes,
it goes right up to you.
To Corliss,
But there was a whole period where, of course, the records have been lost.
They have been lost. Yes, there was a bit of a disaster. Records were kept at Hayes, and during the war, a firefighter who was guarding the records, in fact, dropped a cigarette and they were burnt. And that has lost a whole lot of records. During the war, the census wasn't taken. Earlier on, we're still waiting, I think, for the 1922 census to come out, because it got a lot of flooding damage at that point. And so records were lost for a time. So I think I've been quite lucky with all the ones I have got. And then, of course, they pick up again later on.
Mm. It's an absolutely fascinating book. And you end it by saying that you've made your own little contribution to perhaps future residents' memories.
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I have. We pushed my business card through the floorboards where Corliss's flyer turned up in the hope that one day, I mean, not tomorrow, but in the distant future, somebody will find my card. And I say in the book, I give them absolutely my full permission to reimagine my life in any way the fancy takes them.
That's Claire Hastings. The House in Little Chelsea is out now. To hear more interviews with authors, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue, I think there's over 160 interviews there now, online at monocle.com. Up next, we go through the weekend papers.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you'll get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With four bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
It's time now to look through the weekend papers, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by our friend, broadcaster and journalist, Juliette Foster. Welcome
Hello,
back.
Hello, thank you so much.
So, let's start... Maybe some Brexit? Oh, maybe not.
Yeah, it's like the headache, isn't it? That you take some tablets, you think it goes away and then it comes back again. And the second time around, it's even worse than before. But yes, it has been a tumultuous Brexit week. And of course, it's going to be a tumultuous Brexit week going forward tomorrow, in fact. But look, the reason why I chose this story, and this is The Observer, it is page six. It's a wrench to see them go, but 20 more MPs are on the brink of quitting. We saw, I think it was seven Labour Party MPs from the opposition group actually quitting their party on Monday. Then on the Tuesday, you had an eighth Labour MP who left. Then you had three Conservative MPs who walked out at the same time. Now, it has actually provoked a bit of soul searching in some parts of the party, of the respective parties, and also sniping as well. But the reason why I chose this story was because it tries to give you an insight into the intensity of the decision making, that it really was a wrench for most of them. They quote one unnamed MP, for example, from Labour, who was actually thinking about leaving the party because he was concerned about the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, also other concerns about anti-Semitism, for example. And he actually talked it through with his mother. And his mother said, look, just hold off, because she said, quote, don't give up your career for them. The Labour Party needs sensible people to fight. So it's a bit like having adults in the room. Now, initially, if it had been six MPs who had resigned, or let's say seven minus one particular MP, I'm going to focus on her in a moment, then supporters of Jeremy Corbyn could have turned around and said, oh yeah, it's the usual suspect, they don't like us, because these were people who don't like Jeremy Corbyn, they don't like the way the party's going, they prefer Ed Miliband and Gordon Brown. But what gave this credibility was Luciana Berger. Now, Luciana Berger, she's heavily pregnant, she's Jewish, and she called out the anti-Semitism that was happening in the party. She was genuinely concerned about this. And what's so disgraceful is that she has been on the receiving end of anti-Semitic remarks, and some of these have even extended to the child that has yet to be born. Violence, violent threats against a mother and her unborn child, which is frankly disgusting. She held on for as long as she could, but she just said, look, I can't do this anymore. I cannot stay in this party. And it's a great tragedy for me because I joined it, because I believed in its values, etc. But they've been completely undermined. So one of the points which... some of the contributors to this article have made is that it took away, if you like, this imperative on the part of the critics of this group to say, oh, well, you know, it's just they're just disgruntled because of Brexit. She gave them some credibility because, you know, for her, it wasn't just about the direction of the party's going. It's the fact that it's the anti-Semitism, that prejudice is being harboured, and you've got a leader who appears to be doing very little about it.
Yeah. Now, as you say, she is Jewish, and there is a faith aspect to all of this, because the Sunday Times reports that there is going to be a multi-faith pray-in, if you like.
Yeah, 5 days of prayer after we leave Europe. Europe. I mean,
God help us now.
Yes. And the headline really sums it up: our Brexit chart not in heaven. I mean, it's an amusing story, and I sort of salute the fact that the church is trying to help, because you know what Theresa May, when she became the Prime Minister of this country, she said, "Yes, you know, I want to heal all of us, because this has sort of riven us asunder." But you know, she's failed, because it seems the divisions have got worse. And Justin Welby, who's the Archbishop of Canterbury, he's concocting these plans at his gaff Lambeth Palace, where he wants to have a public prayer for 5 days. So he's trying to work with the Catholic, Methodist, Baptist, United Reformed churches. So 5 days of prayer when we actually leave. He's actually reached out to Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May to see what they think about it. Theresa May's a practicing Anglican, and we don't know what she thinks about it. Jeremy Corbyn, he's never actually been very public about his views, but I think to a certain extent we can guess what they are. Now, it's a great idea, but there are a couple of problems. One is that the church may find it difficult to convince Brexiteers that it simply wants to pray and that it can be neutral, because, for example, you had Nick Baines, who's the Bishop of Leeds, and he recently described the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson as, quote, an amoral liar. And, also, as well, I'm a little bit concerned, because we do worry about church attendance, because we're very good at going to church on Christmas Eve. We're very good at going for weddings and funerals and Easter, but the rest of the time we seem to kind of drop off. So if you can't actually get people to go to church most days of the week, how can you get them to attend this? But interestingly enough, it seems that they've also devised a prayer. Now, this was debuted at the General Synod on Saturday by John Sentama, who's the Archbishop of York. And it includes the lines as prayer: God of eternal love and power, save our parliamentary democracy, protect the High Court of Parliament and all its members from partiality and prejudice. Bit late now, I think.
Well, listen, if God is not your thing, how about the palindrome? There is a wooferendum happening for dogs.
Yes, there is a wooferendum. And I'm genuinely concerned about this, because I have a dog. He's a cross between a German shepherd and a pointer. His dad was a German shepherd. His dad lives in Greece. I don't know where his mother lives, but I've heard that he has a brother who lives in Reading. Now, our dog left Athens when he was 6 years old. He's now 13. Okay, he has an EU passport. Oh. I can also add that he is a hard-working citizen, if you can apply that term to a dog, because at one point he was writing articles for a doggy magazine and he was getting paid. And then they said, "We love your stuff, but would you do it for free?" To which he said, "Jog on." And they parted company. But the point about it was that he paid his taxes on that money. All right, he paid it through me, but he still paid his taxes. And I'm genuinely concerned about this, because what's going to happen to my dog if we end up crashing out of Brexit? Does that mean I'm going to have to take him to Heathrow and sort of wave him goodbye to him on the tarmac? Or will he be spirited away in the middle of the night?
Who knows? I think whatever happens, he needs to attend the wooferendum. So
I think he may have to.
It's basically a huge photo opportunity. Huge cans of Pedigree Chump Brexit Dogs Dinner will be there. and it's a clear message, say the organisers, to tell MPs to come off the leash, vote to ensure that a no-deal Brexit is avoided, and to give the people of the UK a final say. Get your owner to dress you up and bring homemade placards too. So it's a photo call on next Sunday, Hoppers 1 in Victoria Park Garden. So, of course, you've got, you know, the whole of Westminster behind you there. What I think is really lovely about this is, obviously, you know, when you have a lot of dogs together, nature will call. And they say there will be special Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson pee stations in case you'd like to relieve yourself in a political manner.
Well, let's put it this way. Those pee stations, they will be full. They will be very, very full.
Oh, dear. OK, let's move Brexit. Let's get off.
Yes, let's close down that subject now.
So we're going to the Telegraph now, and yes. Schindler's Factory.
Yeah, I thought this was an amazing story, because I have to confess, I haven't seen Schindler's List. It's one of those films which I have purposely avoided, because I am very, very sensitive about the story of the Holocaust. It's the Holocaust, and it has reduced me to tears when I hear about it. But this is an amazing story. And it's got a photograph of a man, and this man is called... his surname is Lobeer. But anyway, I'll find it.
Daniel
Lobeer. Thank you so much. So I did actually highlight it with my red pen. That's it, Daniel Lobeer. Now, Daniel Lobeer, he's a 49-year-old Englishman. And in this photograph, he is standing in the middle of a factory which has been gutted, basically. This factory is symbolic because it was the factory that was run by Oskar Schindler. But originally, it was owned by Daniel's family. But of course, the Nazis stole it from them. They then gave it to Oskar Schindler to run. But they obviously assumed, oh, he's a good Nazi. He's going to run it on behalf of National Socialism. He didn't, because we know that he used the factory. He compiled the list and actually managed to save around 1,200 lives. And it was one of those stories which only came out years later, for which he's been rightly honoured. And what's happened is that Daniel Lobeer, he works for this charity called the Ark Foundation. They now own the factory and they want to turn it into a centre, a museum, which actually tells a story of what Oskar Schindler did. It can also have rooms where people actually discuss racism, anti-Semitism. It's going to be so many things, hence the idea of the Ark. And it's a great idea. And the timing couldn't be better, because we're living in a period of political uncertainty. The things which were familiar, they've now been blown apart. The pieces have risen to the air, and we don't know how they're going to reassemble when they finally land on the ground. And what does concern me is that there's been this horrific uptick in anti-Semitism. It is very, very disturbing, and we do need to be ashamed of ourselves as a society that we have settled Jewish communities. Some of them are thinking of leaving because of the harassment and abuse which they have endured, be it visible physical attacks or attacks online. And to actually have something like this, you know, resurrected in honour of Oskar Schindler, the work that he did, but to actually remind people, you know, there is goodness in the world, and it is possible for pockets of goodness to survive, to actually fight against evil, but to have that conversation. So I really hope that this succeeds and that it's a lesson there for all of us.
Absolutely. And for those interested in the original Schindler story, of course, the film was made after the book by Thomas Keneally. The original book was called Schindler's Ark. Mm. You can find an interview with Thomas Keneally in our archives under Meet the Writers.
Fantastic.
Now, let's go to The Observer. What's this story all about?
Right. So this is Ennio Morricone.
Ah.
Yep, Ennio Morricone. Now, you know who Ennio Morricone is, don't you?
I certainly do.
Exactly. The good, the bad and the ugly. I'm not even going to attempt to whistle that tune. But, yeah, he's a guy who wrote all these scores to the so-called spaghetti westerns. You know, the famous director of the time, Sergio Leone. Now, what's happened is that Ennio Morricone has been interviewed for this book. It's actually called Ennio Morricone in His Own Words. And my take on this is that, you know, he's hugely, hugely successful. And at 90 years old, he's got absolutely nothing to lose, because basically he's been slagging off various composers of film scores, and he basically attacks filmmakers who he says fail to understand the power of music to heighten emotions, and some fellow composers for enabling them to regard a soundtrack as merely something that plays in the background, in other words lift music, to put it bluntly. And you know, he does actually have a point, because if you have a really good score, not just to a piece, not just to a film, but also to a drama, it's meant to, in a sense, it takes the story just a little bit further. It heightens the mood. It interacts with the story. You feel that you really are a part of it. I mean, I love his scores because they've got this wistfulness to them as well, this sense of longing, taking away retribution, whatever. But he's not very complimentary about various people. So, for example, he's also attacked John Williams. Now, John Williams, of course, he scored loads of films, notably Star Wars, you know. And of John Williams, he says that he is an exceptionally gifted composer whom I greatly respect, but even he's criticised for making a commercial choice about the space epic franchise. It was, he says, understandable, but still commercial. I could not have scored Star Wars in that way, which begs the question, how would Ennio Morricone have scored Star Wars if George Lucas had said to him, Ennio, I want you to write this for me? What would he have done? How different would it have been to the tune that we've all grown up with, that we associate with Star Wars?
Absolutely. I wonder how interesting. I think my favourite film composer has got to be George Fenton, particularly for his work on Cry Freedom. That was just the most chilling soundtrack, the most highly kind of emotional soundtrack.
But that's probably a good example of how music, if you think about it, because he's basically saying that sometimes when he was writing scores for people, they wouldn't tell him what it was that they wanted. They just give these very vague instructions, and they just say, oh, well, you know, can't you turn it, do X, Y, Z with it? So perhaps what he's calling for is more interaction between the composer and the director to ensure that everybody really is singing off the same hymn sheet.
Yes. Let's go to Facebook and the story in The Observer about, well, once again, sensitive data being shared without users' knowledge or permission.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess that when I first saw this headline, I had to do a double take. I thought, have I misread it? Facebook attacked over app revealing users' period dates. Period dates for what? And basically, this follows on from a story on the Wall Street Journal on Friday. It was an investigation. They found that Facebook can receive information from numerous apps, even if in some cases you don't have a Facebook account. And this is where it gets really disturbing. It's really gross. But they found that there were more than 70 popular apps which were tested by the Wall Street Journal, and it found that at least 11 sent potentially sensitive information to Facebook, including the flow period and ovulation tracker. Now, that's scary, because the idea that you're keeping track of your period, if you're a woman, either because you're trying for a baby, and we know that for some couples, conceiving can be very traumatic, it can be very difficult for whatever reason. That is something between the couple and those who may be involved, doctors. But the idea that such sensitive data can actually find its way to Facebook, I think that's absolutely grotesque. That is disgusting. And the more I hear about Facebook and these various situations in which it finds itself, to me, it's a classic example of a company which started off with one thing. And it's like, yeah, let's do this, let's do this. And nobody thought about the much bigger picture. What happens when we move to this level of our story or the following level of our story? Nobody really thought about it. And it's all coming out now. And of course, when you hear stories like these, OK, it does evoke these horrible memories of Cambridge Analytica and accusations that Facebook data was harvested, used to skew elections, misused, all sorts of things. And what's going to happen to this company and others like it who are handling our data? Because that data is our goldmine, our personal goldmine. These guys are making money off it. And what are we getting back in return? Very little. So maybe it fuels the argument for perhaps breaking up these companies to have a little bit more responsibility if you believe that they're not actually taking these issues very seriously.
Well, I think we should also never forget that Facebook was something that was originally made to rate women on their attractiveness. And I think as long as we keep that in our minds, that was the genesis of the company, then we'll remember where we are
but
with
then,
that.
But then that same concept as well, that, you know, you're rating women on their attractiveness, and then you're actually invading the gynecology of women by actually taking information, garnering information about their menstrual cycles, and it's going into the hands of other individuals. And I just don't understand it personally. I just find it very distressing.
We've got very limited time left, but let's have a very quick thing looking at the life of Princess Diana.
Yeah.
Apparently there's to be a musical.
Yeah, this is in the Sunday Telegraph. I suppose it sort of appealed to the subversive side of my personality. And it's about a new show in the United States of America called Diana. These previews started at the La Jolla Playhouse in San Diego, California. And it's divided opinion. Some people say it's absolutely outrageous. Some people say it's so bad it's good. Highlights include a shot of James Hewitt, or the actor playing James Hewitt, actually turning up wearing just his boxer shorts, caressing Diana as they stand beside a bed. And in another scene, you've got the Prince of Wales embracing Camilla Parker Bowles, his current wife. The bed there isn't too far away. And the thing which really is worth looking at is the Queen suddenly bursting into song before Diana and Camilla take each other on in an imaginary boxing ring.
I'm going to have to stop you there. This just sounds too terrible. So utterly,
it sounds brilliant.
Utterly tasteless.
It sounds brilliant. Even her former grandmother, Barbara Cartland, the novelist, she appears. It's great.
More.
It's great. We want it on Broadway.
Thank you, Juliet Foster. Thank you for joining me. You've been listening. You are still listening, I hope, after that. Please stay with us. She's going. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Finally, the first Indian chef in the world to receive a Michelin star, Atul Kutcher, is here, and he's here to talk about his latest venture, which is called Kanishka. Thank you so much for coming in. What an achievement to get not one, but two Michelin stars.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me here.
So I just want to talk about your history a tiny bit before we get on. You've got your first star at the Tamarind of Mayfair. That was back in 2001. Your second at Benares four years later. How important is that star for a chef?
I'll just tell you about my experience. When I saw Michelin star chefs while I was working at Tamarind, Chef Marco Pia White's restaurant was kind of diagonally opposite to Tamarind. That was Mirabelle. And I used to see Chef Marco Pia White come out sometimes, sit down there having a cigarette. And I used to look at him and say, wow, a Michelin star chef. And I saw people like Joël Robuchon and Giorgio Locatelli walk down the street. And I just looked at them as heroes. And when I got the star, I actually didn't know how to react. When somebody told me on phone, Atul, you have a star, I said, I know next thing you're going to say you're King of England as well. Please go away. I've got three sacks of potatoes to peel. So I didn't believe it. But later it sunk into me that, yes, it's an amazing achievement. I think best way to put it is it's like Oscars for chefs. Yeah. And we really look forward to have them if we can.
Yeah. Well, so fantastic and very, very exciting that you have a new venture now. Because what you do is pretty unique. You combine regional Indian flavours alongside the best British produce. Are you going to repeat that format in your new restaurant? Tell us what you're doing. And I see that you've brought some of it with you.
I brought some with me, but I didn't get a chance to mix it. But before I leave, I'll mix it and leave it for you to taste. I hope you'll enjoy it. So my heritage is Indian. I grew up, I was born and bred in India, and I came here in 1994 when I was 24 years old. And I started cooking here with very strong Indian flavor and flair as well, because I had trained in India and I thought that's the right thing to do. But I had a visit from my dad 3 years later, who was a self-taught cook. And he saw my food and blasted me out. He said, what are you doing here? Pack your bags, come back home. And I was quite shocked that he had that reaction. He said, look, India is a subcontinent, and we take flavors from all over the country. We remain true to our origin, but we also play with wherever we are in the part of the country. And it's fine that you have left India, you've come here, but you're not using the ingredients from this part of the world. You're using flavors from India, but you're using ingredients from India as well. I see a fish called pomfrey on your menu. I see okra on your menu. I see all stuff Indian which are flown into this country. Where is salsify? Where is sweet? Where is monkfish, which is landed here all the time, grown here all the time? I understood immediately what he said, and I was quite ashamed. And my passion for British ingredients started from there. I started learning very quickly. And I think Michelin star was part of that the moment I started including the ingredients into my own cooking, I learned that there's so much more beautiful flavors to be achieved and explored.
Yeah. Now, in your new restaurant, you are looking at lots of different regions in India.
So when I was doing a new restaurant, I thought, what can I teach British people about Indian food? They know it all. They have been eating this for so many years, and they have been to India so many times. But there is a part of India which even Indians don't know very well, and that is northeast of India. And we call it Seven Sister States, which is Sikkim, Assam, Arunachal Pradesh, Meghalaya, Mizoram. Excuse me. So those states were almost cut off. There's a very narrow strip of land between Bangladesh and India, which actually connects these states. As a child growing up in India, I only studied in geography that was part of India. But physically, I never went there until very recently when I went to Sikkim. So when I landed there, I realized, gosh, there is dumpling, there are noodles, there is raw meat being eaten. There are spices, which we talk about major Indian spices. Hardly any of them exist here. There's Szechuan pepper, there is salt, there's garlic, there's turmeric. There are very few ingredients they use, but they create incredible cuisine. So I thought it'll be fantastic to bring that here and use that in my food. So that's what I'm doing in this time round. To when we open this restaurant, Kanishka, we thought we will bring at least 30 to 40% of the menu from that part of the country.
So exciting. And I mean, not just a taste exploration, a geographic one too.
Exactly. Yeah. And it'll be a journey. You know, a lot of times you look at that food and you immediately dismiss it, saying that, of course, it's Oriental. But when you eat it, you say, no, actually, it's very Indian. Yeah. But it's just the makeover is very different.
Yeah. Now, the way the restaurant is styled is going to be beautiful as well. It sounds like an incredible space. Just describe that to me.
It's a beautiful design, to be honest. Fabul Design have done an amazing job with us. The door itself, it's an ancient fort door which we bought. And it's the main door actually reminds you of India the moment you see it. And as you enter, we have a beautiful bar, the mirror walls. There are hanging ropes. The design has been made with the ropes. And as you go downstairs, they have created another room downstairs, which looks like a kind of conservatory, if I may say that. The kitchen is downstairs. It's open plan kitchen, so people can peep through in kitchen. It's very unique that we have an outdoor seating. We have outdoor right in the front of the restaurant, but at the back we have a conservatory where we can seat about 12 people. And that's going to be the star of the place, to be honest.
Yeah.
So we are really looking forward to it. The color hues are a little bit of emerald green and then pink. So emerald green is on the first floor, and the pink colors have been used in the basement. But I think I'm not doing justice explaining it. One has to come down and have a look at it.
See it. Just quickly before we go, I know we can't taste while you're here, but would you just describe to me one of your standout dishes?
So the one I brought for you, I think, is going to be a standout dish. It's called kachela mas, and which means the raw meat. And it's actually steak tartare. Nobody would think that India would produce steak tartare, but Sikkim does, and Sikkim does in a real good fashion. So they use venison or yak meat generally. I have brought venison for you. And it's kind of mixed with the pickles, onions, eggs, exactly in the same manner. You know, we are so apart from Europe, but we still follow the same ethos there. But the most amazing thing that happens is that if you have heard the word tarka, tarka dal is a very common word in Indian restaurants. So there is a tarka, which is kind of seasoning. So you heat mustard oil, add garlic, chili and ginger to it, and then add mustard seeds to it. And then you pour it over raw venison and then cover it for 2 minutes. And then all that steam and the flavors just get embedded into the smoked venison. And then you eat that with soft-boiled egg and a crisp bread. You can take it. I was looking for crisp naan for you this morning. I couldn't find it. Sorry, I brought some Rivita bread for you, so my apologies.
Do you know what? I'm really glad, actually, that you weren't able to mix it in time, because it means now I can come with you in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
And watch you do it. And I'm going to take pictures of them and tweet them. So thank you so much,
Ashok Kacha.
Now, your new restaurant is Kanishka, and it's on Mayfair's Maddox Street.
It's on 17 to 19 Maddox Street.
And when does it open?
It opens on 27th. We open doors for soft opening, and then we are full on from 16th of March.
Fantastic. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And that's all for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London, produced and studio managed by George McDonough, and our researcher was Mirjana Lagrusta. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be back with you in a moment. But for this edition of Sunday Brunch, that's it. Thank you for listening.